Blog Talk Radio. LA poet, musician, and performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest poet, Sarah Suzor. How are you, Sarah?
I am wonderful, Rich. Thank you.
And thanks for being on the show. Sarah Suzor's full-length collection of poetry, The Principal Agent, won the 2010 Hudson Prize and was published by Black Lawrence Press in 2011. She also has a forthcoming collaboration, After the Fox, which is co-authored with Travis Cibula and will be available from Black Lawrence in 2014. Sarah's reviews and interviews can be found in Tarpaulin Sky and Rain Taxi, and she has recently guest blogged for the Best American Poetry series. Sarah's poetry has been published widely as well as anthologized, translated, and nominated for the Pushcart Prize. She lives in lovely Venice, California, where she is a founding editor for Highway 101 Press, a correspondent for Omni Dawn's online magazine, Omniverse, and a guest lecturer for the Left Bank Writers Retreat in Paris. Well done, Sarah.
Oh, life is good. Life is wonderful.
Life is indeed good. You know what? Speaking of the good life, why don't we start out today's show by having you read a poem or two from The Principal Agent, the collection that won you the 2010 Hudson Prize.
Absolutely. You know, briefly before I get into this, I'm going to read from a section called Isle of Dogs. And I actually speak to Tiresias, the blind prophet, in it. So, if I bring up Tiresias, that's who I'm talking about. Isle of Dogs. Tiresias, you and I, we barely know each other. Take off your jacket, will you? You say she has obsessions. You say she can't remember. These are all things I know. And what about you? There's hardly anything to speak of that hasn't already been mentioned, except, of course, how you've been spending your evenings. Did you tell the experts about that? I didn't think so. So I'll stop there with that one. But
it's
a love story, chase kind of a thing. Yeah.
Well, you know, actually, when you were reading that piece, it reminded me of something that I felt when I was reading some of your other work online. In a number of pieces I read, I had this feeling, almost a conversational quality at times, but yet, you know, very poetic, very well written, but almost like you were kind of like now, almost talking to a lover or someone very close to you. And I found this thread sort of running through a lot of your work, and I'm wondering if that's something that you're aware of, or it's something that just sort of comes naturally, or something you've had to work at.
You know, I think for me, there's always got to be this muse. You know, you always have to pull from a muse, and it's kind of a good way to mask everything else. You know, it's an easy way to relate to other human beings. You know, everybody has experienced some sort of heartbreak or, you know, exceptional love. But for me personally, using a muse, it's easier to talk about some things that are more political or more, just a little bit more difficult for everybody to relate to, you know. And but that right. muse is a great way to get in there and, like, you know, work through some of that stuff.
Right. You know, you've said that The Principal Agent is a book of secrets, and the poet Elaine Sexton also described it as a narrative made up of fragments that expose a razor-sharp intelligence, an unnerving sophistication, an echo of the poet Anne Carson. And I was hoping you could talk about how secrets, fragments, and other themes and ideas came into play when you were creating the collection.
Yeah, I deal a lot with this idea of the, and, you know, we'll get to this later, I'm sure, but the truth is just such a, you know, the truth is so relative to me as it is to you, Rich, as it is to, you know, 100 different people you ask on Venice Beach. So I think that, like, the idea of secrecy and truth, what's true and what's false, it's just such a wonderful thing for me to explore.
Right.
And relativity, I think that is, you know, human nature. It's just relative to whoever seems to be experiencing it at the time. But it is definitely one of my favorite themes.
Nice. So the collection won, as I said at the top of the show, The Principal Agent won the 2010 Hudson Prize. How did that come about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I had actually written a manuscript before that, and I had shelled it out to just about every prize you could possibly submit to. And nobody was picking it up. It was a finalist at some places, but nobody was picking it up. And I just, you know, I was kind of panicked. So I'm like, all right, well, okay, that's not going to work. I need to come up with something else. And immediately the principal agent just, it unfolded in front of me. My, you know, what I was experiencing at the time and putting into words, it just, it really, truly, I lived The Principal Agent, you know, and it came to me, you know. It was a gift. And, you know, I had submitted it to a few places, and people seemed to pick up on it really quickly. It was something that people could relate to pretty quickly. And Black Lawrence, you know, they must have liked what they read.
So actually, that was a question I had for you. If the Hudson Prize was associated with, because a lot of times literary presses will have these prizes, and if you win the prize, they'll publish your manuscript or whatever. So the Hudson Prize was associated to Black Lawrence Press? That's how they came to pick you up?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, okay. I had done, like, it was technically my first book, if it would have been published. So, or, you know, at the time, if it would have been published. So I was going through and looking for a lot of first book prizes, and I just came across the Hudson Prize, and within a matter of months, they were calling me, and
right.
It was
good.
The best day of my life.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course. You know, I read online somewhere that you had a funny backstory to the book. I was wondering if you could share that.
Yeah, I went to actually a business conference in Chicago, and I mean, all of this economic jargon was in one ear and out the other, as far as I was concerned. And then they started talking about the principal agent being fill in the blank, and then the catalyst being fill in the blank, you know, in economic terms, you know.
Sure.
And for some reason, I just thought, well, if I took that and I twisted it into a more poetic sense, you could come up with some phrases like the principal agent you know, was right. You could do whatever you wanted with that.
Sure.
And the idea of changing, well, the economic term is principal AL, but this is mine is LE. So it's the agent of principles. But yeah, there were just a lot of possibilities in that. But it was funny that it was this thing that I barely even was listening to, and then all of a sudden, inspiration.
So how hands-on is Black Lawrence Press in regards to getting your work out into the world? What are some of the various avenues they explore for, sharing your work with others?
Oh, they're amazing. They really, truly are amazing. They have, I can't remember what press it was, but they just came out with like the 25 top presses that prove independent publishing is the way to go in 2013. And Black Lawrence and DeZank were on there. But they are really remarkable. They do such a good job social media-wise, marketing, and they, you know, set up readings for me. They promote readings. They're really, really active and hands-on. It's been wonderful working with them. Yeah, they're amazing.
You know, speaking of promotion, there was perhaps a day when a writer, you know, found a publisher, and that writer thought, okay, I've got a publisher. I can let them take care of the business end of things, and I can just focus on the writing. You know, I think it's a very different world now. And that said, how involved are you with your own self-promotion, and what are some of the different things you do to get your name and your work out into the world?
You know, self-promotion is pretty much a full-time job. Not really, but
It really is
these days. You know, it's almost, you know, a little embarrassing, but at the same time, it's wonderful to me to do things, because do readings, set up readings, and do stuff like this, because it's under your own control. You know, you can totally control how you're being presented to the world. And I think that is one, you know, you don't just get to sit back and, you know, let people make assumptions about you. You can actually answer their questions and read online what they said 3 years ago. And so I think that, you know, I personally just love opportunities to be able to talk about, you know, any opportunity I get to talk about the writing and the work. But at the same time, I am constantly working at this, you know.
Yeah.
It is not a sit back and write job.
And you were talking before, you were just talking about how much of a full-time job it is, and I know that for myself also. But have you at least sort of, and it sounds like you have, but have you seen it sort of pay off for yourself to like, okay, I know I'm putting in all this time, but at least I'm sort of getting some kind of reward here or there?
Oh, absolutely. I never, anything that I do, I don't expect anything out of it. You know, one of my favorite poets, L.A. poet Paul Vangelisti, he always says about poetry in particular, nobody's selling out because nobody's buying. And I think that is it's such a beautiful reminder that.
Yeah, that's funny.
I know. But, you know, I don't have.
And everything, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. See, I used to think of it as sad, but now I actually think of it as like a positive thing. But you know, it's a beautiful reminder that I really shouldn't have any expectation about the effort that I put forward. And if it does turn into something wonderful, then, and if it does get recognition, then that is just a major added bonus.
Right.
Yeah.
It's nice to know, you know, that for poets like us, you know, the bar is set pretty low. And so, you know, anything we can get above that, it's like, yeah, this is great. But otherwise, you know, we're not asking
but
for
then,
much.
You know, on the other hand, though, it's I always have said this, you know, when it is rewarded, when something you do intellectually is rewarded, it is worth more than a new Jaguar. You know, it's just
absolutely.
When your intellectual abilities are rewarded, it is priceless, you know,
yeah.
And I feel like that's why you choose to do something like write poetry or, you know, aspire to write fiction or nonfiction or whatever. You know, you don't really come in it with dollar signs in
no.
your eyes.
Yeah, you know, I've told this story before, I've had people, you know, come up to me after a performance, come up to me and just say a remark that in that one remark, I just think, man, you don't know how much that one remark has just like made all this hard work worth it, you know, and it's just.
Not exactly. No, I know.
Yeah.
I know. And, you know, it's. Yeah, it's a lifestyle that you live and, you know, I don't know. You know this better. You know this just as well as I do. But it is truly the most rewarding feeling to be able to express yourself in words. You know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have another collection that I want to talk about, The Prettiest Girl in the World, and I sort of want to ease into that by talking about looks for a moment. And you know, when I first met you through Joe Donnelly Slake, and when I first saw some pictures of you online, I couldn't help but to think, wow, you know, what a fresh face looking sort of sort of the quintessential Southern California girl, or that sort of, you know, she could win the proverbial prize of the girl next door. And then, you know, that got me to thinking of like what one thinks a poet should look like, you know, the whole sort of like, you know, sunken eyes, consumption and all these like,
yeah,
you know,
right.
disease ridden and impoverished. And, you know, and I think of you and I think, oh my God, you know, Sarah's sort of the complete antithesis of that sort of quote unquote look. And I'm wondering, like, have you ever gotten any people that, you know, look at you and assume that, you know, because of you look the way you look, that you shouldn't be a poet or that sort of thing?
You know, I have. I've gotten a lot of feedback about that. I think most of the feedback, people are just shocked when I say, oh, you know, I do numerous things, but I also write books. And people look at me like I've just, you know, landed from Mars. I mean, they just can't believe that. But I think more than anything, it's one of the reasons that I find, like I was just talking about, the gratification from, you know, when you read my work on a page, you don't see my face, you know, and there are there's something super fantastic about it. It's seriously just, if you connect to the work, you are just connecting to my mind. You know, you're
exactly.
not connecting to how I look or how I dress. And there's something just so rewarding about that again. But, you know, it's kind of I think a lot of people don't understand that when you are an author, you take on the role of whatever character you're trying to portray or whatever message you're trying to portray through your character. And I
Right.
think that, you know, there are probably a lot of people that read my work and they think that came out of quintessential California, you know, they just get, and I've had people basically say, I cannot even believe that someone like you, who looks like you and act like you, can write something like that. But you know what? It's you take on that role, and I think that that's really important for people to understand.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, intellect and critical thinking has always been, you know, something that will always drive me, you know.
Yeah.
I was never, I mean, I went to school for journalism, and I remember my grandpa was saying, oh, you would be the best broadcaster, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, good Lord. No, thank you. No, thank you. I would rather be the one writing the copy, not just reading the copy that somebody else wrote.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So The Prettiest Girl in the World, from what I've sort of heard about it, I gather that it's kind of a mix of highbrow, lowbrow. A woman named Jessica Piazza, I'm not quite sure if that's how you pronounce her last name, but there was a quote that said, if I had to choose a poet to watch bad reality television with, it would be Sarah Suzor. And I think she wrote that in reference to The Prettiest Girl in the World. Can you talk about the collection a bit?
Yeah, it's, you know, The Prettiest Girl in the World basically came from this idea that, well, a few ideas, but, you know, we as human beings just try and survive and get through the day any way we can, any way we know how, any skills that we've acquired along the way. But there are all these things like advertising and marketing and images that you feel like you should obtain. And one of them is the prettiest girl in the world, you know?
Right.
And to me, in this collection, the narrator is actually a man, in my eyes. And he's looking for the prettiest girl in the world. And when he gets her in the book, she's actually, you know, a headache. And that, to me, is symbolic of a lot, you know.
Right.
It's symbolic of a lot of, you know, all the
and
time
so
people
true.
Spend. Yeah. You
and
know, all
so
the time
true.
People spend slaving away, wasting their lives so they can have the perfect image of anything, a house, a car, anything, a girl, a boy. And in the end, it's never quite as satisfying, and you know. So that's where but, you know, we're all just, it's just a book about we're all just trying to get by every day the way we know how to do it.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to read a short passage from one of the poems in that collection called Problems, and I think this might sort of touch upon that idea of something you mentioned earlier about truth is relative. So, anyway, maybe you can expand upon that after I finish, but this is from one of your poems. However, what makes a liar is relative to the truth. What makes the truth is relative to the charmer. What makes the charmer is relative to the audience, or forgetfulness, or forgiveness, or the phase of the moon, the lyrics of the song. So again, that was an excerpt from the poem Problems, which is in the collection The Prettiest Girl in the World. Yeah, so maybe you could talk about that passage a little bit more, Sarah, and how it relates to the whole poem.
You read that wonderfully. You read it exactly like I read it. That was great.
Well, if you're ever on a reading tour and need a stand-in writer,
I know who to call for it. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's kind of funny. On that idea, I went to see a good friend of mine, amazing writer Ben Lurie, read from his collection of short stories, and there was this one story he was asked to read, and he said that he wanted to read it, but he couldn't because he always would start crying if he read this particular story. So he had me come up and read the story for him.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I almost started crying too.
I bet.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk.
Well, you know, that piece in particular is just a wonderful example of all of this outside influence that I'm trying to bring into the book. You know, you hear things all the time, and, you know, people say things to you all the time. Well, you know, it's the phase of the moon. Well, Mercury's in retrograde. Or, you know, you hear a song that distracts you from the way you were thinking, or you hear a song that brings you into the past and takes you out of the present. And that little passage is just basically elaborating on the fact that we're all going to think whatever we're going to think at the end of the day. You know, I can tell you my life story, and I can try and, you know, give you all kinds of advice, but the truth is relative to the truth, you know, yeah. The liar is relative to, you know, that's basically just elaborating on this idea that we are all just individuals, you know, and but again, here are all these like easy outside influences that could come in and, you know, sum up your problems in 3 seconds, you know. It's, you know, it's a blessing in disguise, Rich. Don't worry about it. It's a blessing in disguise. And you're like, yes, that makes me feel so much better. And then when you're alone, you're thinking, I don't know if it's a blessing in disguise. Like, that actually really hurts, you know. Yeah. So that's basically, you know, all of that runs through the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So a writer that you've been collaborating with a great deal lately, Travis Cibula, how did the two of you meet and how did you decide that you were going to work together?
Well, he and I met through, I was actually editing a student journal while I got my MFA at Otis in Los Angeles. And I was editing a student journal and we got some of his work submitted to us. Because he knew one of my old teachers, Elizabeth Robinson, an amazing poet. He was one of her students. And so he submitted to us because I sent out the call for her to pass around. And we picked up his work and we published it. But what was so impressive about this submission was his submission letter. And so he always just stayed in the back of my mind as this character. We also published the submission letter. Like, we totally put it on the back. We're like, this is a prime example of how you should submit your work, right? And so he just stayed in my mind as this character. And then we got to meet 1 year in Boulder. And we just had an instant connection. And gosh, it's really hard to explain, but I was reading in New York and he and I decided to read together at the reading. So we came up with a little ditty about New York to read at this reading, and it turned into an entire manuscript.
Is that After the Fox or?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yep. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Which is due out next August, correct?
Yes, I'm so excited.
So why don't you talk a little about the collection? So it stemmed from that original sort of writing that you two did together, and then where did it go from there?
You know, well, we were writing back and forth, and I was addressing him as Nocturnal, this, like, character of night, you know? And he started addressing me as Morning. And we just took this binary, night and day, and we wrote a book that starts in New York and then goes all the way to the West Coast, and where we just constantly chase each other because we're binaries.
Right.
And also, you know, I'm a woman and he's a man, and, you know, we're just, it's that constant chase. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was reading some of your work with Travis, and it's really quite fluid. I mean, did that just happen naturally, or did you two kind of have to work a little bit to get into that groove?
Not at all. We didn't have to work at all. And that's almost the most frightening but fantastic thing about Travis and I, is that because we did this all by email. I would write a piece and email it to him, and he would write a piece and email it to me. But when I would see his email come in, I could not even open it and read it until I had proper time to come up with my own response, because otherwise I would be preoccupied in my normal life. You know, I just had to respond to it immediately. We just had this, and the way, there are little things that we take from each other that carry right through, and what we do with them is just so natural. That's the best way I can explain it.
You know, this just got me to thinking of something. Years ago, I had this writing relationship with this woman that I had just met very briefly one night here in L.A. She had seen my band perform. She lived in Maine, of all places.
Yeah.
She was visiting a friend in L.A. We exchanged email addresses, and like for the next year or something, we just kept writing back and forth, and then developed this really intense relationship through writing. And then, like, when we met again, like a year or so down the line in person, not that it was disappointing to see her again in the flesh, but I don't know, it was like we had created this, through writing, we had created this relationship that almost superseded anything that could have come together in the flesh. And because you've been doing these writings with Travis, and, you know, and it's such an intimate experience, and going to so many, you know, different levels with one another, I'm curious, is there ever a disconnect when you two meet in person as opposed to when you interact through writing?
Interesting. And you know what? There isn't. There is
good.
Not.
Good.
There
good.
Never is. I mean, we, in writing, we are much more dramatic. I will say that. We are, you know, we write like we are these drama fiends. You know, we're just feeding off drama. And in person, it's actually just a bunch of laughs. But it's never, that intensity between us never dies in terms of understanding each other. We just, and it's, you know, it took, I was actually the person that brought up to him, we should write a collaboration. And he had a lot of projects going on at the time, and I don't know how willing he was to do it. And then I was right. we just started. And seriously, we can't stop.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that, you know, there's a really good balance of, we just have a good understanding. We have a wonderful friendship, and he's a brilliant, brilliant individual, always keeps me on my toes. So that has really helped our writing relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe you have something from After the Fox, the collaboration you're working on. Maybe you could read something for us.
Yeah, I do. I actually have a piece. Again, I address him as Nocturnal. And he has just promised me that he will meet me in Los Angeles. But again, we're night and day, so technically we can't meet. So that's kind of what this piece is about. Hang on, I've got to flip my page here. All right. It's 12:01, Nocturnal. It's tomorrow already. You don't know this, but in the thick of downtown, There's too much noise to hear anything. It's filtered, filthy, otherwise. I'm not going to say one thing about us. Faith is like fire, a four-letter word, and I've been counting. I've become good again. Is that what you were hoping to hear? Once or repeated, I said, is that what you were hoping to hear? This is the finest I've felt lost. It's an easy decision. I follow the one-way streets, and everything is alive because nothing else can exist. No moonlight to dance in, no shadows to chase. It's always straight as an arrow, always on the way to a dead end. But I'm not going to say a thing about you. Wherever you think you are, you aren't. I don't mean that mean. I just mean it. I wouldn't kick you if I could. I wouldn't start something I couldn't stop. Ever. If you're here, if you're here, I'll be back by the Pacific. Pick a time and a place. Pick your favorite song on the jukebox. Pick your feet out of the darkness and show your tired face. Once or twice, or wait, just once for the first time. Nocturnal, do you remember the first time? I don't, and I've been counting. Every notch is another hole in the head, the heart, mine or yours, it doesn't matter. I hate to sound like a broken record, but it never ever did. It never ever did too much for me, Nocturnal. But I'm not going to say another thing about us like that. What's that saying? Fake it till you make it. Half of life is just showing up. Same thing as far as I'm concerned, same exact thing. I suggest you arrive early. Have a cocktail waiting for me. Choose a pretty place, something with a view, somewhere I can walk to the water and throw my feet in the waves. Pretend you're trying to impress me. I'll buy it because I want to. Because, unfortunately, we are not going to die tomorrow or today. Same exact thing as far as and filthier. I suggest you wear red or blue. Wear it like a stranger. I hate to say it, but I like you best that way. And I don't mean that mean. I just mean it. So that's that.
That was beautiful. Sorry for stepping on you earlier. I have to get more in tune to your beautiful pauses. It was really... It was really, you know, he got me to thinking, like, man, if Black Lawrence doesn't do audio books, they should totally start doing audio books for you, man, because you got such a beautiful voice. And yeah,
thank you. I agree. He is just as fantastic as a performer as I am. I mean, that's the great thing about performing with him, is that people who don't even know anything about the history of poetry, or they haven't read a book of poems forever, can identify with he and I performing, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty, that means a lot to me, you know?
Yeah. Have you two been doing very many readings from this collection yet, or are you going to wait until it's released?
You know, we've done a few, but I am really excited for it to get released because it really is something super special, and I don't mean to brag, but it really, it's not all me, it's him too, you know, and but it is such a special dynamic. And it is like a show. If you were to come watch us and listen to this story, it's a show. You know, it's a story. And so, yeah, we will get, when it is released in August, we will do a lot.
Yeah. So in working with Travis or with anyone else you might have collaborated with, how do you feel your own writing has changed?
I don't really feel like it changes my own writing. I feel mm-hmm. like it gives me an outlet to write outside of myself when I work with other people. And I think that is priceless, you know, just to be able to explore another voice. And I remember telling Travis or talking with Travis, and we were like, we don't even know if this will go anywhere, but this is the most I've been able to write in a long time and feel good about. And
wow.
It's just feeding off another person's energy. I'm sure you know that as a performer.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
You just, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and last week I had on the show Suzy Roach from The Roaches, and she talked quite a bit about, you know, collaborating with, you know, other artists like Philip Glass and these people, and, you know, how much she loves the collaborative process because it really helps to stretch her as an artist.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And yeah, it is my favorite pocket tool to go back to. Because, like I say, it does get you out of your own writing, you know,
yeah.
and you know, you can, and your own ideas even, you know, it just eliminates that stagnation.
So you and Travis are working on another book too, I believe, called Riot?
No, it's called Last Call.
Oh, I'm sorry, Last Call, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right, I'm sorry, Last Call, yeah, and talk about it.
Okay, briefly, it's a wonderful book, but, you know, he and I had this idea that we would take serious issues and speak through voices that sound ignorant, maybe, or unsophisticated, and talk about major, major issues through these voices. And we have really had a lot of fun with it. We've played with rhyming and, I mean, things that we don't normally do. So it's been great.
And that's interesting because, you know, with After the Fox, you know, it's not that it's like your voice is nocturnal and morning or highbrow per se, but it is very elevated. And so that's interesting that you would, the two of you would make a call to sort of go hick or lowbrow on this one.
See, that's exactly that's what I love about this collection, is that it is so pedestrian, if you would,
right.
You know. And but at the same time, we're actually talking
about
big
issues,
not
right.
Just like some binary man-woman relationship, you know what I mean? We're talking about bigger issues than I guess are addressed in After the Fox, but we're talking about them through these pedestrian voices.
Nice. Do you have anything from Last Call that you can read?
Yeah, I do. Okay, well, there are a few characters that keep coming up in the book, and, you know, one of them is a cop, one of them is some crazy know-it-all local. One of them is some one-eyed woman. So we'll just keep returning to all these characters. And Travis has just thrown me something about how he saw a dead antelope on a fence, which I am assuming is commenting on the overpopulation of antelope. But anyway, this is my response. I know nothing for certain, but I've tried brushing up on everything, and I guess there's no four-legged creature that can tell a wire from a string. It's about brains. That's the trick about traps. So I keep my eyes peeled, my head down. Better than crying in my soup or nailing my own feet to the ground. Screw the cop. He was a lazy drunk. Couldn't even get the most incriminating piece of evidence out of his trunk. We need someone who can read the future. that one-eyed woman west of the tracks. I'll ask her for information. She always advises the highest form of defense, which she calls sublimation. Read about that. Of course, it's more work for us. It'll entail coming up with our own creation. Maybe something someone else can read. Maybe something someone else can write. It's not the easy road, but it'll be better than sitting around playing someone else's music all night. That's what the one-eyed woman calls repetition. She agrees. It's about brains, she says. If there's no water, you best not sit here and wait, she says. And if no one can look you in the eye, you best find someone who's at least shooting straight. And she wasn't talking about guns. So I'm wondering, what do you know about things that disappear? Geographies, geometries, souvenirs. What do you remember about fragility or frugality or anything that sounds even the slightest bit sincere? Two heads are better than one. What should we build? One of the locals told me all the world's secrets are on a highway somewhere, just waiting to be spilled. So that's a little sample from that one.
Nice. And and I hope you noticed how I just, you know, kept out of it. And just
I did.
And let you read. And I was like, okay, there's a pause here, but it's a Sarah Suzor pause. And I'm going to, like, just bathe in this beautiful pause. And I know she'll continue. And I'm just going to keep my damn mouth shut.
I so want to coin that. A Sarah Suzor pause. I like that.
The quote on the back of your next book. I love to luxuriate in the beautiful pauses of Sarah Suzor. Oh, my goodness. Man, there were so many great lines in that.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's like the fun part of it is we just can, you know, talk about things that we don't normally talk about.
Yeah.
Now,
you have another book, I believe. You're just doing so many things. I believe you're working on another book called The Slow Movement.
Yeah, I am.
And what's going on with that?
You know, it's kind of about the artist, you know, it's more of a mature book for me personally. And it's taken me a long time to put this together, but I think that, you know, the artistic, it's not a plague. I'm not going to say it's a plague, but I'm just, you know, you have to relive your art all the time when you're an artist. And sometimes it's difficult to do that. And it's an emotional endeavor. And I think that this next book is more of an exploration into that, you know? So it's a little bit more mature. It's not it's more dealing with the artistic process and how it has affected other artists. You know, I read a lot of letters that artists have been, you know, writing to their family, you know, Vincent van Gogh and all of his letters. And I think that I get to speak about that in a very mundane way when it's actually a very complex idea.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the artist process or the artist struggle, you know, so many people have so many differing opinions about what makes a poem, a poem, or what is a good poet, you know, what isn't a good poet. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts. What to you makes a good poem?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know, I
got you stepping
wow,
into that.
Wow, Rich, thanks. throw me to the wolves on that one.
But you know what I mean? Because the people, especially when it comes to poetry, it seems people are like, they have very strong opinions about what is a poem, what isn't a poem, what makes a good poet, what makes a bad poet.
You know, I think more than anything, it's just my personal like or dislike with anything is relative, clearly. But I love when there are, I've been reading a lot of, like I said, Paul Vangelisti and Dennis Phillips, they're LA poets, and there's so much back and forth between the complexity of life and the simplicity of life, and how they work with both of those things. The simplicity maybe being nature, and the complexity maybe being politics. And I love how they can manage that fine line without throwing too much in your face at one time. And so I think that there's something with that I definitely identify with. And I don't necessarily know if that's, it's like being a person, being, you know, I'll probably speak to the person that doesn't throw their opinion down my throat, you know. They'll right. bounce their opinion off me, and then I'll bounce mine off theirs. And, you know, I think that a lot of that kind of work really speaks to me rather than just having it thrown at me, I guess, is the best way I can describe that.
Right, right. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to make sure we touch upon a couple things before we part ways. First of all, is there anything else you want to read?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. You have started, you have helped to found Highway 101 Press. I was wondering if you could talk a little about it.
Yeah, we have. I have a co-editor in San Francisco, Annie Pantilla, and we founded Highway 101 just kind of as this, you know, it's a chapbook press, so it was just a way to contribute to the community, you know, on the other end of it. And I think, you know, there's something really exceptional about being able to be an editor and a writer, because you realize really quick what stands out in writing. You know, you understand, like, wow, whoa. We actually, before Travis and I had even worked together, we published one of his books, and it was about Marie Antoinette and her death and, you know, the whole process of it. But the first page said, it, you know, she talks to her husband, Louis, the, I don't even know, the 14th, 15th, 17th, whatever. And so she talks to him throughout the book. But the first page of this manuscript said, Louis, the first time, does it hurt? And she's, of course, it could be, you know, referencing a million things. But, you know, it's been such a wonderful process being an editor and also a writer, because you, I mean, that line just stood out to me. I didn't even have to read the rest of the book. I was like, of course we're going to publish this. You know, this is amazing, you know. Great, wonderful, fantastic. So, we have one book that will be coming out probably next year. And then I think I might move on and book a full-length press.
Oh, nice.
I kind of want to publish full-length books. Yeah. I mean, I love chapbooks and I love art books, but I think that there's something about, I just think that's my next step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say the academic world has taught you about writing poetry versus just being out in the world and living?
Not a thing.
Good one.
No, I'm teasing. Well, it taught me how to, like, check things off and get things done. But it didn't, I mean, you know, I feel like if you're a person with an artistic tendency or an artistic soul, it's not about teaching people how to connect with that. It's about inspiring people through what has already been created, you know? And so I feel like that was what was so amazing about my academic experience, is nobody was sitting there saying, you can't do this and you should do this. And they were just seriously teaching me that words are powerful and you need to be very careful with the power that you have to put things into print, because they last forever and they're a reflection of you, and or a reflection of some character of yourself or something, or character of whatever you want to dream up. But I think that there was nothing necessarily taught about any of that.
Right. So not to put you on the spot or anything, but if you had to write a one-sentence synopsis of your life, what would it be?
Oh boy. My life?
Or where you are these days, you know.
Well, I always say I never have
a bad day. Or about surfers or, you know, whatever you want to do.
Surfers, okay, I can tell you a lot about them. No, I'm just kidding. I just, you know, me personally, my life, I never have a bad day. I mean, like I say, I can find inspiration in the tiniest, smallest moment or the tiniest comment. So the shortest interaction. So I think that that is basically, that's me. You know, it's that's the best way to sum myself up.
What a wonderful
never
way
a bad day.
Never a bad day. I love that. And what a great
even
way
if
to
it's air. A bad day, I know how to fix it. Yeah.
Good for you. With me today has been the lovely and talented and equally high-minded and thoughtful Sarah Suzor. Sarah, where can people find out about you? Read your work online.
Black Lawrence, on the Black Lawrence website, they have a link to all of my books, and also some of them are on Amazon. The principal agent is, and After the Fox will be when it comes out in August. And yeah, if you Google me, there are a lot of links. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Sarah.
Rich, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and a big shout out to Travis Cibula. Hey,
yes,
Travis.
Yes. Yeah. In case I didn't say that 19 times. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, and I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. And for those of you listening in the LA area, tonight, there is the 4-year anniversary celebration of Susan Hayden's Library Girl at the Ruskin Theater in Santa Monica. There will be reading and performances by Sissy Boyd, Eric Truls, Richard Modiano, Jerry Garcia, not the one from The Grateful Dead, John Hess, Carly Archibek, Crystal Lane Swift, and myself. There will be music by Mason Summit. Admission $10. You can get the tickets online at the Ruskin Group Theater or just show up at the show. 3000 Airport Boulevard in Santa Monica. Tune in next week when my guest will be writer, founder of The Nervous Breakdown, and creator of the wildly popular podcast series, Other People, Mr. Brad Listy. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.